Our subject this morning is phenomena versus experience. Now, I defy you to make something of that. However, there is an important point to be made in this. Phenomena is an old Greek word, and it signifies something fleeting, something ephemeral, as opposed to noumena, which is essential and permanent, central to the reality. And what many people do on the spiritual path is mistake the one for the other. They think that because they're having some sort of experience, we could also call this experiences versus experience. They think because they're having some sort of temporary vision or something that this is an important thing for their spiritual growth. Well, it's important to understand that merely seeing a vision is not the important thing for two reasons. One, because it may be, and very often is, not a superconscious or true vision, but comes from the subconscious. Secondly, because what is really important is what affects you, what will change your life. Your experience, as opposed to something that you have experienced, means that which is you are the sum total of your experiences in life. The experience that you have had in life, as opposed to things that you have seen passing before you merely on a screen. Indeed, a true superconscious experience will be it will affect your whole life. It will affect your outlook on things, and it will have, usually, but not necessarily, it will have the kind of impact that I mean when I talk about experience as opposed to experiences. There was a woman who came to the meditation group that Yogananda had in outside Boston in about 1920, who the very first time she came there had this amazing experience spiritually, where she was able to see through the wall, to realize that matter was not real at all. She saw the thousand-petaled lotus. It was an experience that most people would be delighted to get. And because it came so easily to her, it didn't mean anything. She never came back. She thought, oh, well, that's interesting. But you see, it takes a little while to begin to appreciate what these things mean and for them to add up to that kind of experience of life which will make you what you're really trying to do, somebody who is free from ego, free from delusion, free from those things that pull you down. And experiences as such are like going to the movies. There is this story of Trailunga Swami, who had a disciple who was always begging him to give him a vision of the Divine Mother. And there was an image of Kali in their prayer room. And they were in another room talking, and Trailunga Swami said, well, you've wanted an experience, so Divine Mother says you may have one. And the door opened, and this statue walked in the door and sat down and talked for a while. And the disciple was, of course, thrilled. Then the statue got up and walked out and resumed its own stone-like appearance, and the door closed. And Trailunga Swami looked at the disciple and he said, but now what have you got? It was wonderful while it lasted, but has it changed you? The things that we see are not nearly so important as the things that get down deep within us and affect a change in our consciousness. And some of these experiences are things that we're not that aware of consciously while they happen. We it's gotten in on a deeper than conscious level, but it's affected us. Like when I met Yogananda, and he put his hand on my heart, and it vibrated for 2 minutes, and I wasn't spiritual enough to feel the power of it at that time, but instantly my whole consciousness was changed. And many things fell away, and I just had a different outlook on life as a result of that blessing. Well, it was an experience, but it was so subtle that my conscious mind couldn't grasp it. All it could see was the effect of it. So it's a very important thing, because people have a tendency to think that God has to come in a certain way. They place conditions upon how God ought to come to them, and because he hasn't come in that way, they say that I haven't experienced anything of God yet. And yet, you see them and you see their lives changing, you see their attitudes changing, you see that there is a constantly growing peace and understanding and love in their hearts, and you see that indeed God is coming to them. But they have thought, well, no, they've given a definition to what it means to find God. Master had this same experience, or at least he described it, in Autobiography of a Yogi, when he asked Sri Yukteswar, after Samadhi even, he asked him, when will I find God? And Sri Yukteswar said, you have him. Master said, I don't think so, sir. And he said, oh, I see what you're thinking is that you should be having all sorts of phenomena. And he said, joy is God. Then Yogananda realized, well, yes, I have joy. The important thing then is to recognize that God can come in many ways, but all of these ways are important to you only to the extent that they actually affect your life. Now, in truth, I don't think that any real answers in life come except from the superconscious. People, I was saying this the other day to a few of you, that people who think about things and think their way to solutions, they're thinking within a framework. And they think they've found a solution because they've moved away from this spot of trouble. But all they've done is shift their attention over here. It's not a solution. And the reason I can say it's not a solution is that they very easily drift right back into the same problem all over again. And all their thinking is still within a certain framework, and it's very hard to break out of that framework, because we, on a conscious level, can only deal with the data that we already possess. It's from the superconscious level that new data can come in, new attitudes can come in, new ways of looking at things. You really, and for a permanent answer, this is even more true. But it's only from that superconscious level that suddenly you gain the clarity to be able to deal with things in an effective way, and suddenly to understand, well, of course, that's what it is. Many times people who come to me with this problem or that problem, the real solution is what Larry Marsh, I said, do more Kriya. Meditate more. In meditation, you alone, you can get to that point where suddenly you understand it, and I can give you all the reasons, all the explanations, all the advice, all the stern admonishment, whatever it might be, but if it doesn't come from within, it won't come. And if it doesn't come from the superconsciousness, it won't be really from within. It'll be from that part of your mind which is always engaged in the senses and seeing things in an outward way. The inner experience, then, is the important thing. Now, in this context, I would be inclined to say that if you have a true superconscious experience, it's likely to be a very good thing. But don't go looking for that. Look for God. Still, because it is basically a good thing and has the greatest chance of doing some good for you. Master said he had so many visions, he's brushed them away. They were an obstacle to him. But that's not most people's problem. what we can say is that it's important to learn how to discriminate between a subconscious and a superconscious. I remember in meditation many years ago suddenly seeing a large green face. I don't think it was superconscious. But somebody who had never seen any kind of face might say, wow, Krishna. Of course, Krishna's blue, not green. But anyway, close enough. So people get very confused about the kinds of visions that they have, the experiences that they have. They have a tendency to take some little thing and blow it up into a big experience. And in fact, that's another reason not to get attached to your experiences, because what you want is cosmic consciousness, not some little vision of angels or something. All of these can be very nice, but they're not what it's all about. Now then, many people call these subconscious visions false. They're not false completely. In one sense, we can call them all false because they're all phenomena. Everything out of God is a phenomenon. Everything out of God is something temporary, ephemeral, and only in the absolute vision of God can you say that you've reached beyond phenomena. Yet, there are different levels of reality. This world that we're in right now, it too is a dream. It's, however, not unreal. It's real, but as a dream. You see, when you're dreaming and you see things, you're seeing things. It's real that you're seeing them. It's just that it's not objectively true. Other people don't see them. And so what you experience on the subconscious plane needn't necessarily be something to be afraid of or to feel badly about. The subconscious mind, the imagination, can in fact be a help. It ceases to be a help if you get attached to it. If you start seeking that instead of going always beyond that. And it can be a help if, seeing that, you offer back to God whatever it is that you've seen. Thus it is that any experience that you get can be good for you if you always offer it back to the reality behind all phenomena. In this sense, then, we must see that the experience of the subconscious is actually a path to the superconscious. Master said you have to go through the subconscious to attain the superconscious. I think you can bypass the subconscious, but it's very close. When you get into deep meditation, you come to that dividing line between the superconscious and the subconscious. It's a very fine dividing line. If at that point you don't put out the willpower to enter the superconscious, you may slip into the subconscious, and you can see all kinds of things, hear all kinds of things, and may even take them for real. How do you distinguish, however, between the superconscious and the subconscious? Well, first of all, that criterion that I mentioned in the beginning, which is that it won't really affect you. A superconscious vision will more deeply affect you, whereas a subconscious vision and your subconscious dreams that you have at night, these things are sometimes interesting, sometimes scary, but never do they really have a profound impact on you because they're on a superficial level of your mind. A really deep experience will be, first of all, very calm. There will be an underlying consciousness of joy. There's always a feeling of joy and deep calmness when there is a true experience. Joy less than calmness. Sometimes, after all, what you're being given is a warning. It may be frightening. So can you speak of joy in that case? Yes, if you're detached enough, you'll feel the joy. But if not, you won't. Yet calmness will definitely be there. Calmness is the is that which you require in order to be deep enough for it to be a superconscious experience. So what you have when you have an ephemeral experience, a merely subconscious or imaginary experience, is something that doesn't touch you deeply enough to change you, something it isn't very vibrantly and deeply calm. The light, if you see it, won't be brilliant. It will be sort of dim. The joy, if you feel it, will be a merely emotional thing. It won't be pure joy. It won't be an intense joy. It'll be a merely emotional reaction. All the state of consciousness that you have, you see, the difference between the subconscious, the conscious, and the superconscious is essentially one of different degrees of intensity of awareness. On the subconscious level, there is much less awareness. On the conscious level, we are more awake than on our subconscious level, and we're aware of it. I remember an interesting dream that I had once where I dreamed that I was levitating. And I thought, well, I was flying through the air and sort of talking to friends up there on the third story, out their window, and I thought, well, this is a curious thing to be doing. I must be dreaming. So I tried to discriminate and logically to decide whether I was dreaming or awake. And I finally came to the completely logical conclusion that I was awake. And then I woke up and I was so surprised to find that even with all that logic, I was actually still dreaming. And another time, I even took it a step further. I decided that maybe I was dreaming, but now I would wake up. So I woke up, but I was still dreaming that I'd awakened. And it's so funny to play these different levels of consciousness. Sometimes our dreams can be very instructive in that way. I remember a dream I had many years ago when my ambition was to be a playwright. And halfway into a dream, well into a dream, I decided that one of the characters in the dream didn't help the plot. So I went back to the beginning where he had entered and left him out and went along happily dreaming. It's good for us to be able to be aware of our subconscious enough to be able to manipulate it. And in that sense, it helps to... I remember when I was wanting to be a writer, I was 14 years old at the time, and I wanted to experience what I wanted to write about, so I felt it very deeply, and I spent a long time visualizing things. For example, I remember mentally standing on board ship, a sailing vessel, with the spray coming and the wind blowing and the cold and the dark lowering clouds and the creaking of the boards. And I sat there for a long time trying to will my mind to feel that this was really happening, to the point where it became vivid to me. And this is a very good practice. You see, that's why I said that it's not bad if you know what it is. It's not bad if you don't get hooked in it. The imagination is that which, first of all, helps you to break out of your own little mental enclosures. Secondly, helps to put you in touch with higher realms. For instance, Master gave us various visualizations to do, didn't he? He spoke about visualizing yourself sitting in a room, a light surrounding your body, expanding that light to fill the room, expanding that light to fill the whole house, the whole countryside, the town, the city you live in, the country, the continent, all the continents, the world, expand beyond the world to include the solar system, the galaxy, all galaxies. And this is just imagination. But what makes it a good thing is twofold. One, it helps to clarify your mind and to expand your mind. And second, what you're really visualizing in this case is a reality. It's not as if you were... It would even be helpful to try to imagine yourself a green toad or a cloud or anything you want to. But there would come a point beyond which you couldn't go because you weren't imagining truth. Where here you're trying to imagine that which is truth in order to break the hypnosis of thinking that you're an ego and a body. And you use a good imagination to overcome a bad imagination, a truth to overcome a falsehood, and then gradually you attune yourself to a level of truth where you're far, as Master said, beyond imagination of expectancy. You go into a superconscious realm where you absolutely know this is true. And one way you can know it's true is that you can influence lesser realities. A higher reality, to be in touch with a higher reality, gives you the power to influence and change a lesser reality. For example, by a slight degree of higher awareness than just subconscious, I was able to manipulate that dream and to say, all right, I'll get rid of that character and introduce a new one. I can't do it on this level because I'm on this level. I can't just say, well, I've decided to have another group of people for this class this morning, and suddenly you vanish and a new group appear. Here you are. No, it's not something we can do. I can't just say, well, wouldn't it be nice if we were in the Himalayas, and there we all are. Because we're caught in God's dream, and we have to go along with this level. But if we can dream on a higher level, we could indeed find ourselves in the Himalayas, or do any kind of manipulating of the atoms of this world that we choose. We have a disease, we choose to restructure the whole programming of the energy in our astral body, and the physical cells would have to go along with that new programming. And so, to use a higher imagination helps you to dispel the lower, But once you've gone beyond just imagining into the reality, then you'll find that it isn't imagination, and your proof that it's not imagination, apart from the fact that your actual awareness will be millions of times more intense, is that you'll be able indeed to change anything you want to down here. Miracles become perfectly commonplace to God-realized masters. They don't seem like miracles anymore, because it's just no more miraculous than for you to change your subconscious dream, which may not be usual, but it's certainly possible. So, when we use imagination in the right way, and it would be good for you to recognize the importance of imagination in your spiritual growth, in whatever it is that you do. I have seen that, for example, in writing a piece of music. This to me is a good example, because what I have done is the same thing that I did on board ship in my mind when I was 14. I visualize very strongly what it is that I want. And if I see it clearly enough, if I can imagine it clearly enough, then it's automatic that the melody that fits that mood comes to my mind. And that's why I've been able to write melodies for different countries, and then people from those countries say, but it sounds as if you were writing our music. And the reason is that I'm seeing it clearly. When I was writing the music for Mediterranean Magic, for example, I visualized each place. It was a little more difficult, because when I had written the Egyptian music, I had felt the vibrations in those temples, and they were very strong, and they were very individual, and it didn't take much imagination just to try to tune into those vibrations again, and then the melodies came instantly. But with the Mediterranean scenes, I didn't actually feel vibrations there. So I had to imagine the vibrations I would have felt if I had tried to feel vibrations. I went there more as a tourist, just seeing the places. And for example, in Pompeii, the tragedy of the eruption of Vesuvius destroying the city, the evil or the worldliness of the people, the intense selfishness of the people that brought about that thing karmically, and yet at the same time the recognition that this is, after all, 2,000 years ago, the tragedy isn't any more really tragic, and their sins have surely been expiated by now, and it's not all that intense, so it has to be somewhat diluted by the interest of all the people just going and seeing a fascinating thing that happened in ancient history, but their hearts aren't touched by it. And I had to have several different considerations all put together, and then I had to have it something that would uplift and not depress. After all, we don't want another eruption of Vesuvius. We want to get out of it, not into it. And so with all of those things, when I had a very clear image of what I wanted, then I said, all right, now, Divine Mother, give me that melody. And instantly that melody came. And again and again, I found that in writing music, the same thing happened, that visualizing very clearly, for example, when I've wanted guidance on something, it isn't often that God will come to you out of the clear blue sky and tell you something that you hadn't even imagined, tell you something you weren't mentally even prepared for, tell you something that shocks you, perhaps. It isn't often. It does come sometimes. It does happen sometimes that we suddenly have a revelation that we were not at all expecting. But usually what happens is that you get a very strong feeling that this is the direction that would be effective, good, right, true. But you don't get that kind of feeling unless you can very clearly see what you're looking for, and possibly also alternatives to it. And I found that having a clear concentration, you need not just imagination in the vague way. If you want that level of imagination which is going to lead up toward the superconscious, then it can't be vague. I talked about false visions, imaginary visions, hallucinations, but all of these things come more onto a passive mind. Whereas if you're offering your mind dynamically, using your imagination, but to offer it into the superconscious for guidance, for illumination, for understanding, then you have to be very concentrated, very positive, very uplifted in the direction of your energy. And then if you use your imagination and don't wait simply passively for God to tell you, which sometimes He'll do, but not often, then you will see that the more you can really bring into focus the kind of question you want to ask, most people don't get an answer because they don't even know what they're asking. That's the fact of it. They would like some sort of vague answer to a vague question, but almost invariably, if you ask your question with enough force and clarity, you don't have to ask it of anybody else because the answer is right there. The answer is built into the rightly asked question. And I found in counseling that almost all my effort is directed toward, needs to be directed toward helping people to ask the right question. Because once they've asked the right question, then, oh, it's perfectly clear. So, visualize very clearly what you're asking, what it is you want. See it, smell it, hear it if you can. And then see what the effect would be. Feel from a superconscious level, because that's where solutions come from. The conscious level gives you problems. The subconscious level gives you merely an escape from problems. That's not a solution. The conscious mind makes you aware of the problems. That is to say, it analyzes, it distinguishes, it sees how this is different from that, and it sees differences in all things. And thus, with those differences, it becomes aware of problems. It sees that here is this thing and there is that thing, and how do I bring them together? Or here are all these things, how do I get out of them? It sees disunity, not unity. The superconscious mind shows you the way out. The superconscious mind, there isn't a problem to which there isn't a solution. Sometimes the solution is only going into the superconscious. That was the solution proposed or offered by that Zen Buddhist monk when he was asked to solve some question. I forget the exact nature of the question, but I presume it had to do with a vase that was sitting there on a table. Whatever the fact is, his answer to it was to break the vase. And he just smashed the vase and walked out of the room. And they said he'd passed his test. Because very often, merely just denying the problem and going to the superconscious is the answer. However, often, too, the superconscious will show you what to do in this realm, how to deal with that vase, how even to put it together again, what to do in order to help your living problems in life. And so, when you take this imagination of yours and make it very clear, the more clear you are, the more conscious you are. The more conscious you are, the closer to superconscious you are. And so that clarity in itself is an aid toward reaching toward superconsciousness. Master said that a master materializes something is to visualize it very strongly until finally he sees it in his mind. And then he projects that which he sees even more strongly until finally the energy gathered is so intensified, so condensed, that it actually takes on a physical form. And as long as his mind is held on that, it remains in that form. That's why, again, he said that astrally produced phenomena are temporary, because you don't want to keep your mind fixed on a thing forever. And when your mind says, all right, I forget about that, then it disappears again into the ether. But all of this, then, is in the direction, the difference between imagination induced by your willpower and imagination simply brought up from the subconscious onto a passive screen is that the one can help you really to advance. The other can become an addiction, a trap. It can be a way of deluding you. People very often are deluded by something that they feel to be beautiful and right, and so they go off in a direction which years later they realize was a big mistake. How do you know the difference? Well, you don't always in the beginning. It takes a lot of practice to be able to distinguish between what seems like a right feeling and what is a right feeling. It's only after years of practice that you come to the point where you see, ah, when I feel that way, it isn't right. I fooled myself in the past. And when I feel this way, then I know that it does seem to work. And so when this feeling comes, this particular kind of feeling, then you go with it. When the other one comes, then you are suspicious. Until then, it's very good to have the advice of people who have been longer on the path than you. It's very good to listen to the counsel of others, because otherwise you will make many, many more mistakes. So, how do you distinguish between one and the other? The degree of consciousness, the degree of willpower. When your will is really in it, when your will is offering it up to God, when you try always to keep clear in your mind that the one you love is God, not the gifts that he's giving you. There was a boy who came to Mount Washington many years ago, and I was in charge of the monks, but I didn't have much experience. And I made mistakes sometimes in the people that I would accept. And there was this one person whom I was very impressed by, because he had all these voices giving him this wonderful guidance, and I thought, well, wow, it'd be wonderful to have all this, and he must be very advanced. But in fact, it was all his imagination. And later, it was really a tragic thing. He left Mount Washington, and he got involved in some situation, and this voice told him to kill somebody, and he did. And he threw a bomb, which killed himself also. And it was just all his imagination. It came clear over a period of time living at Mount Washington, and this is the big test that I'm wanting to come to. For you to really understand, it came clear because his attitude was wrong. You can't have superconscious experience, true superconscious experience, and have a lousy attitude. He was very egotistical, very selfish, very negative, very all the things that you shouldn't be. And the real test of your spirituality then is your experience, yes, but what is that experience? What does it do to affect your life? How does it change your life? It all comes down to not how many visions you see and how many wonderful experiences you have. It comes down really entirely to what kind of an attitude you develop as a result of it. In The Imitation of Christ, there is a lovely passage which talks about the ways of working of the ego and of divine grace. The ego, I wish I had that book with me, it would be too long to look for, but at any rate, essentially it's this, that the ego, the natural man, finds satisfaction in being obeyed, in having his desires fulfilled, in being over other people, in being looked up to by others as important, in having possessions, and so on. The flow of grace is that which enables you to feel joy in being under other people, in being unimportant, even in being despised by other people, in having things taken away from you instead of given to you, in finding that people don't listen to you, or that things aren't going right, that you're always given the more difficult jobs to do. All of these things the ego rebels at. The ego hates to meditate. The soul loves to meditate. The ego hates anything which seems to make the body less important. The soul is delighted to see things that make the body less important, because the soul wants to get out of body identification. And so if people treat the body disrespectfully, the soul says, oh, good, thank you for the reminder. And the soul doesn't care at all, and rather it finds cause for joy in that which the ordinary worldly person would be angry about. It doesn't mean that it's a soulfully right thing to do, is to be a doormat to everybody, but on the other hand, as a reminder of your inner freedom to take the most difficult task, the lowest task, the lowest position, to be happy in that, this is one of the signs of freedom. The right attitude, I don't mean to imply that the right attitude is one of self-abasement, but one of joy. Under all circumstances, whether you're abased or not abased, whatever happens, you don't allow things to get to you. Things just don't get your goat anymore. When you find that somebody is really functioning more on a superconscious level, he's somebody who's always positive. He's solution conscious, not problem conscious. He's always looking for a way to help people, not to get even with them, not to hurt them, not to be hurt by them. It doesn't matter. If somebody, like that wonderful story of Milarepa, which I told you a few weeks ago, he was a yogi in the Himalayas, and he lived in a cave and had nothing to eat except nettles. And he would make nettle soup and nettle salad, and as a result of this, his whole body turned green. The hair on his body was green even. And he was sitting there naked in this cave with all this green hair and green skin when some hunters found him and thought that he was a ghost and ran away fearfully. And he called to them, and when they realized he wasn't a ghost, that to work out their anger at themselves, their shame at having been afraid of him, they started to beat him up. And he was a fragile man. After all, he did was sit there and meditate. So they were doing him serious damage. His only thought throughout that beating was pity for them, compassion for them, for the karma they were accruing. And he was praying for them that they not have to suffer too much. This kind of attitude is not possible for the ego. The ego would think, how can I get my revenge? The soul is only capable of that level. Now, when you see people whose attitude in life is becoming more humble, more joyful, more serene, more able to take the ups and downs of life peacefully, when you find that people are eager to do whatever has to be done and not thinking in competitive ways, yeah, I've done it 3 times, you've only done it 2, that kind of attitude. Actually, a large part of becoming spiritual is like growing up. I remember my brother and me on the Wagon Lee coming over from Romania to America, which we did every 3 years. And those little train beds are rather narrow. And we were both in one bunk. I forget whether our parents put us at opposite ends. I think that's what they did. But we had sort of a line that we drew down the middle of the road, and if one toe crossed that line, you did it like this. And, well, many people when they grow up are a little more refined, they've learned to dissemble, but it's still essentially the same fight, and they're all out to protect their territory and protect their rights and protect everything, and the least little thing that they don't like, and they're suing you. And when you come onto a superconscious level, you suddenly think in a very, very different way. And you think in terms of, how can I help? How can I bring unity, not disunity? Because the superconscious level sees things in a way of unity. Well, now, this is what I see on the path when people advance spiritually, that their lives really change. It's a wonderful thing to see how even in a week after people have come here, their faces are becoming more relaxed, more peaceful, their eyes are clearer, their minds are clearer, they're able to think more in a unified way of the welfare of other people and so on. This is what you should be looking. When I speak of your experience, I mean basically really that the experience in life that leads to maturity. Why do we no longer act like little boys in a wagon-lit train bed? Because experience has shown us that it's a waste of time, that we lose not only time but energy, that it doesn't get us anywhere, that if we can learn to take care of the other person, he'll take care of us, so all this competitive spirit gradually rounds itself out. I remember this again, just thinking of my brother and this song that he sang one time, because he was intensely competitive with me. He was a year and a half younger, but half the time he was taller than I, and had this thought that, why should I listen to him as the older brother? I'm bigger. And one time when we were 12, I guess, I was 12, he was 10, in The Hague, in Holland. And he sang this song, Donald dear, is it quite clear that I have won the day that I have won the day. Not a bad melody, but anyway, what you do is, as you become mature, it's essentially the same difference as the difference between insanity and sanity. An insane person is incapable of relating to anybody's realities but his own. And if he's the emperor of Russia, then he's the emperor of Russia. And the fact that you don't see him as that doesn't enter into the picture. Whatever he sees, that's what he is. He believes. Well, an immature person also is not to that extreme, but nevertheless, he's unable to relate to other people's realities than his own. He's only thinking of what he wants, and if he doesn't get it, he's perfectly capable of lying down on his back in the supermarket on the supermarket floor and throwing a tantrum, as many a little 2-year-old and 3-year-old has been known to do. He couldn't get his chocolate, and all he can do is scream. Gradually, you begin to adjust to the fact that there are other realities, and the extent to which you have adjusted to that fact really spells the difference between immaturity and maturity. A mature person is able to take many different points of view into account, to understand where other people are coming from, not to impose his desires on a situation, but to say that, all right, what would be better for everybody, and so on. All of this comes to people if they take their experiences of life seriously, or perhaps I should say, if the experiences that they have in life really enter into them and affect them. Because all of the experiences of life that we have tend toward that lesson, toward learning that lesson, that there are other points of view, there are other realities, there are other needs. And once you've expanded to that point where you've taken that seriously and don't just keep fighting against it, some people remain children even into old age. In fact, it's astounding how few people ever become mature. It's astounding how people in their 60s and 50s can be just as selfish and grabby and incapable of relating to anyone else as little children. They've only learned to pretend, that's all. But apart from that, look at the lawsuits they instigate. Look at all it's astounding. I remember this article that I've mentioned sometimes from the Reader's Digest many years ago of a man who was killed in a hit-and-run accident. And his son vowed to get that person who killed him. And after 20 years, he finally put all the pieces together to have the law arrest that person, and the case was strong enough, and the man was put in prison for having run away from the scene of an accident caused by himself. And so the article went on to say, and he slept well for the first time in 20 years, and so did a lot of other decent people in his town. As if decency meant revenge. So how can something like that get into the sort of, you might say, the weather vane of public opinion in America, the Reader's Digest? To want revenge is a childish thing. There's this, the world will go on. Why should you waste your life over some little thing like that? Just, you've got your own life to lead. We've all got to go sometime, and so it was his time to go. But revenge, pettiness, hatred, anger, if you turn on the TV set, you will find within the first few minutes somebody getting angry at somebody. It's just a part of people's thinking. They think that you're not being real if you don't get angry with people every few minutes. In many a novel I have read, the beginning of whatever heroic deed is accomplished is anger. In many another novel that I've read, you find people behaving in purely petty ways to sort of assert themselves and their own little importance. So, people are immature, basically. But if you take your experiences inwardly and try to understand what they're coming to you for and what you've got to learn from them, then indeed you become mature. Then indeed you begin to recognize other people's right to breathe, other people's right to disagree with you, other people's right to work out their karma by attacking you if they choose to. It's their problem. You don't have to take it onto yourself. Why not just choose to love? Why not just choose to forgive? And why choose to love and why choose to forgive? Purely and simply because you're only happy if you do. And if you want to be happy, why let them make you unhappy? However they treat you, just love them anyway because you're happy then. Why let them hurt you twice? Hurt you by the thing they do to you and then hurt you by making you angry and taking you out of your happiness. Your happiness is the only thing over which you have absolute control. If you choose to be happy, you will always be happy and no one will be able to make you unhappy. If you choose to be unhappy, no one in the world can make you happy. This is something over you, over which you have control. And thus, no matter how people treat you, if you can love, if you can forgive, all of these attitudes give you happiness. If you want to criticize, be negative, hurt, get even with all these various put-down attitudes, they will give you unhappiness, whatever you manage to foist onto them. And so what we find is that there are certain mature attitudes, and what makes them mature is that they help to broaden your sense of reality. And what happens as you broaden that sense of reality is that you get away from this delusion which keeps you bound to the wheel of reincarnation. Because basically what holds you is the thought of identity with your little body and your little needs, liking this, disliking that. If you can break out of that, then bit by bit, accepting other points of view gives you that sense of unity and that sense of expansion which automatically leads toward superconsciousness. This is, in a sense, you might say, the social way of attaining cosmic consciousness. But if people don't have that, Master said, for example, don't think that you can gain God's love if you don't know how to gain the love of your fellow beings. If you think that in the name of being very spiritual, you can sit around insulting everybody because it's all a dream and it doesn't matter, God won't be pleased because God is in them too. Granted, he's dreaming through them, but still he's in them. So we have to see that our attitude is the very basis of everything spiritual. You know, many people reading autobiography of a yogi would get the impression that Master's discipline of us was sitting us in a corner and putting his hand on our spiritual eye and saying, all right, now concentrate. You see those clouds? Now bring them to a focus. Now a little bit more to a focus. Now see that hole in the center of that cloud? Now try to go. You'd think that that's what it would be all about, wouldn't you? It wasn't that way at all. His whole training was attitude. His whole training was getting I remember, for example, some people were standing there criticizing something that Master had done. You can't do anything without getting somebody criticizing you. But for a moment I thought, well, that's a point, isn't it? And I thought about it for a while, and then I realized, no, it wasn't a point. They were the ones who were wrong, but I had wanted to see it. And then I felt badly that I had doubted Master. And so I came to him and I said, sir, I'm sorry for doubting you. And he very affectionately said, that's the way. In other words, talk about it. Be truthful. Be sincere. Be humble. And apologize when you've made a mistake. In other words, attitude. Attitude. When the attitude is right, then everything good can come. But if you cling to a wrong attitude, if you cling to selfishness, if you... he was always working on our humility, our selfishness, our need for generosity, and our positive, cheerful attitude. He was always trying to get us to put out positive energy. That's why when he asked me how I was and I said, well, he said, that's good. He didn't want to. He was very strong on positive, cheerful, right attitude. As he always said that a yogi should be even-minded and cheerful. And he was always trying to teach us even-mindedness too. To the point where as soon as he would see us getting attached to something, he would put us into something else. So as to break us of all those attachments, we'd get too locked in a certain job, he'd put us over here. We'd be too attached to a particular way of working, he'd put us into some other kind of work. I remember my own way was not the way of manual labor. I was always working on more of a level of thinking and philosophy and that sort of thing. And he had me mixing cement for months. I remember I had to give a Sunday service and all my hands, because in those days we had to mix it all by hand. My hands were creased with cement. And I was saying to one of the men in the colonies there, how can I come out in front of the public looking like this? He said, what do you mean? That's your badge of honor. And I thought, oh, that's right, it is. It shows that we're practical in our religion and not just dreaming about it. But he had me doing that until he saw that I was doing it joyfully. And I was, in fact, doing it very joyfully. I was just chanting Om Guru every time I threw the sand in the cement mixer, and it was great. It was great fun. And then he put me into work for which I was more adapted, writing letters in the office and so on. But he always had us go back and doing the other two, lest we lose touch with the ground, lest we lose touch with our bodies, because we have to develop on all levels. But that also is to help break the attachment. Anytime there is something that you like or don't like, he would try to, for instance, he told us about how Sri Yukteswar one time asked him, how do you like cauliflowers? Master said he didn't like them at all. A week later, Sri Yukteswar said, how do you like cauliflowers? Master said, well, I told you, I don't like them. He said, you've had them in everything you've eaten this whole week. And that kind of discipline is good. He disguised them in different ways, but Master found that if there was something, for example, that people thought he absolutely loved, he would give it up for maybe a year. Just to not allow his mind to hold on to the thought that I have to have this. And he would very often, for instance, with his training, if I'm given something that I don't like to eat, I'll eat at least a little bit of it, just for the discipline of it. It's a good discipline to train your palate to like anything. It's a good discipline to take food into your mouth, especially food that you like, and hold it long enough there to make your mind accept that you're not even conscious of any taste there at all. Have something very tasty there, and then tell yourself you're not tasting anything. It's a very good practice to train your senses to behave themselves. To not, if you don't like cold, for example, take a cold shower every now and then. Finish your hot shower with a cold one. Anything that you don't like, make yourself do, even a little bit. You can overdo it. I remember one time I took a cold shower in midwinter and stayed there so long that literally for 2 days I was shivering. You can overdo. But as a practice, if I had done it, which I had started to do just a little bit at a time, then it's a very good discipline for the mind to be able to take what you don't like and to reject or refuse the pleasure of that which you do like. And in that way you reach the point of learning to be even-minded and cheerful. Somebody asked me the question the other day, how do you get out of what seems to be a law of life? Somebody called it the Pauling principle. But I said it's ridiculous for it to be called a principle named by a person when it's something that the scriptures have talked about for thousands of years. But he saw it as a principle of physics, that for every one kind of experience, you get an opposite kind of experience. This is just duality. That's the way the whole world is made. But he had observed it in physics, and this was a great insight of his to apply it to human life too. And she said, how do you get out of it? I found that when I get completely into enjoying something, then the very next day, the very next moment even, I will crash from that and I will experience just the opposite. And the more intense the crash also. She said, how do you break that? How do you get out of that? I said, you never get out of it. This is the law of Maya that you can't escape. However, you can get out of it in another way, and that is to recognize that it's the intensity of your involvement, your commitment, your reaction to it that brought about the intensity of the pain also. And if instead of going with a high or with a low, you remain even-minded, so that whatever you're enjoying outwardly, you take it into yourself and don't allow yourself to get sucked into it, then the opposite will come, but it will be almost pleasurable too. Because you'll see it's all the drama of life. It's like Macbeth, and you're seeing all these people getting killed up there on the stage. There's practically nobody left. And you go out of there and you say, what a great play. I really learned something. People can't do that so easily when it happens to them. But the more even-minded you are, the more you find that indeed you can do it. Even-mindedness is not apathy, but it is a means of beating the system, the fluctuations of Maya. When Master Metsri Yukteswar, they both felt an emotional joy at finding each other again after many, many, who knows how long, certainly not from this lifetime. And the joy that they experienced had to be turned into also a pain. The less ego you have, the more instantly that repercussion is experienced. If there are a lot of what Master called the thwarting cross currents of ego, you may experience the pain a lot later and not have any idea what it's related to, but it'll be merely delayed. It'll always come. In Master's case, it came right away that Sri Yukteswar wanted him to go to college. Master had left school with great declarations of never having any more schooling and wanting to give his life to God. Here he'd found his guru and was ready to give his life to God. And the first thing his guru told him to do was to go back to school. And Master couldn't face his family with that new reality and having them tell him, you see, we were right, we told you so. And so Master said, never. And Sri Yukteswar said, you will come back in 28 days. And Master said, never. And so they parted on a little note of strain. And Master said, Master said, that's dual scales of Maya that balance for every joy is opposite sorrow. And the more, because they had experienced the joy, therefore they had to experience the pain. The more you allow yourself to experience a joy outwardly, the more you'll have to experience its opposite pain. There's no way you can break that, because it's the very framework of the universe. It's what makes the universe possible. Without duality, everything would merge back into the one and become spirit again. But if you're not identified with those things, if you take it inside and are even-minded, then it's very different. The intensity won't be there, but it's not apathy, because you're always in joy. And you're able to enjoy, in this case, the thunder and lightning and rain just as much as you enjoy the sunshine. You're able to enjoy the drama of life and its ups and downs, and it lends a lot of spice to it all. And so you have the chance to be even-minded, yes, but cheerful all the time. You enjoy everything because you see it as a spectator and not absolutely committed to one and therefore absolutely committed to avoiding its opposite. You see both as a part of the whole scheme of things. These are attitudes which come with experience. And it's experience that we need on the path, not experiences. Except to the extent that experiences help us to cope with experiences of life and to gain a deeper experience of what it's all about. I'm equating experience with the maturity that you gain from living sanely, wisely. as opposed to the experiences that come to you, which you may or may not gain from, depending on you. But a person of experience is not merely, you speak of a person as a person of experience, maybe if he's lived through a war, suffered a great deal, traveled all over the world. But do you speak of his pet turtle as a turtle of experience? No, because the turtle to the turtle, it hasn't really happened. He's not that conscious of what's going on. And in fact, most people are like that turtle. They're not experienced merely because they've traveled, or merely because they've been through a war, or merely because I've seen people come out of travel and out of war and out of great, terrible experiences, not the least the better for their experiences. They're not experienced. They've merely been sort of subjected unreasoningly and ununderstandingly to the hammer blows of fortune. But an experienced person is one who has taken what he's seen and learned from it and gained from it. And this is what I'm talking about when I speak of experience. That when you grow on the path, you become a person of experience because you learn. You see patterns. You begin to see how it all fits together. You see that how when you behave in such and such a way, it doesn't work, even though originally you thought it might. You begin to see how to draw from the superconscious level and use it in your daily life. And not see a difference, a chasm between the conscious and the superconscious. Not see how they don't relate to each other. These are the important things on the path. When you meditate, you should try to go as deeply into God as you can, but then take whatever you feel into yourself and see what it can do to affect your consciousness. If you have a problem from that level, look down upon the problem and see how to understand it more clearly. This is a lot more important than dividing your two worlds and thinking that your meditations have to be samadhi or visions of Krishna or all those things. No. In fact, spiritual development is a lot more difficult to understand and perceive than, let's say, putting on weight. You can quickly see if you've gained a pound or two. But the changes on a mental level are more difficult to observe. The changes on a spiritual level are even more subtle. And it may take a long time before you notice it. You know, when you're climbing a staircase, you're not thinking of each stair that now I'm a little higher and now I'm a little higher. And each step you're just a little higher than you were. It's only when you get to the landing that you look back and you say, oh, I've come this far. You measure your progress upwards in terms of rests. And so also, your measurement of your spiritual progress will be at certain landings, not all the time. But indeed, other people can see you going up. Other people will be more aware that, my, look at how he's changed. Look at how more peaceful he is. Look at how much better he's able to relate to others, how much more understanding he is of them, how much more compassionate he is, how much more humble he is. He's not always competing and trying to look important. He's not playing those old ego games anymore. These things other people can see quickly, much more quickly than you can. And that's why it's good to ask the advice of people who can help you. And that means a lot of people here, because everybody's trying to help you in a spiritual way. It's just that they sometimes aren't mature enough to give the right advice. But even so, a little bit of feedback from people is very helpful, because they'll be able to tell you if you seem less in tune than you were. Then you will find at certain periods you'll look back and you'll see, I've come a long way. And that seeing, what you see, will be not in terms of, well, last month I only had 3 visions, this year month I had 6. It's not like that. It's that now I suddenly find I can cope with things better. Now I suddenly find that I'm a different person. I am more experienced. Not, I have had more experiences. And that experience is what will ultimately lead you to the highest experience of all, which is samadhi. So don't look for these things. When they come, be grateful. Don't, many people say, well, you want the giver, not the gift, and therefore ignore whatever visions or whatever spiritual experiences God gives you. Well, good heavens, if you want to give something to somebody and he throws it in the wastebasket, you'll think twice about giving it to him again, won't you? You certainly don't want to reject these things. It's rather that you express gratitude toward the person who gave them to you. Love him all the more because he has so many lovely things to give you, maybe, but whatever it is, give them back to him in this spirit that thank you for what you have given me, but it's you that I love. And so in that sense, the energy, instead of suddenly, you know, supposing you give a present, a Christmas present to a child, and the child takes that present, oh boy, look at this, and he goes off into a corner and plays with it, you'll feel grateful to a certain, or gratified, I should say, to a certain extent. If the child takes it and says, I didn't want that, you won't feel gratified for sure. But won't you feel even more gratified if the child takes it and, oh, thank you, Daddy, how wonderful of you. Isn't it true? Your energy has not rejected it. It's grateful for it, but it recognizes instantly that it was the love of the parent who gave it to him that is the real treasure. If in this spirit you look to the giver, then you will find that your experiences will be taken in to add to your total life experience, which will make you a more mature devotee and more worthy of receiving God. So you don't want to keep those experiences out there on a screen. You want to take them in as you take every life experience in, not seeing them as different from anything else in life. All of these things are a part of your total life experience, which if you take it in and allow it to affect you as a person and to change you, can really add up very quickly. And the more from the superconscious they come, the more quickly they will add up to that purification that will make you recognize on the deepest level your oneness with God. So don't treat the spiritual path as a sideshow at a circus with all these odd things going on. People who think that they're becoming spiritual because they're suddenly interested in UFOs are really missing the boat. And in fact, one of the great obstacles on the path is missing the point. Or missing the boat, as I put it, but I don't think Patanjali used that expression. Missing the point, not seeing what it's all about. Take it inside, offer it up to God, make it a part of your total experience of growing more and more toward Him, and you will see that the sum of all of that is to be seen in your daily attitudes of life. How those attitudes change toward yourself, towards people, towards your work, towards everything. If you can see yourself becoming more positive, more cheerful, more even-minded, then be happy. There's one disciple that I know who never had any experiences at all. And other people were getting all upset and worried because they weren't having enough experiences, and she said, I don't know what they're worried about. We're perfectly happy. We found our guru. We're serving God. What's there to get all depressed about? And she was always cheerful, always serviceful, always a really wonderful person. And Master thought very highly of her. It just wasn't her karma to have these experiences, but that she was a saintly soul was beyond question. God is much more interested in what you are giving him than what you are getting out of him. Learn to give more. Okay, thank you all.